Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, the second day of April. Welcome, 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 friends. On Into the Program, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. President Trump gave a big primetime address last night about the war in Iran, his first such speech. People were anticipating perhaps he would announce some big news, some big changes. Didn't really happen. I think the median reaction was,
Yeah.
So if you're confused, what do? You go to the experts, right? We have two of them with us this hour to kind of parse where we are with this war. What has Iran learned? What have the Americans learned? How has this changed our global alliances? And how might all of this end? Because it does seem in some ways more muddled than ever. And we're asking you that question, by the way, today. How much longer do you think this war with Iran will go on? And how do you foresee it ending? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and I'd love to get people's comments, whether they saw the remarks or not. We'll be playing some clips, so you'll get all caught up. But we'd love to get your predictions. How much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? Again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And it is Thursday, which means it's DJ of the day. But we got a little bit of a teaser here.
Remix, remix, remix. yeah, we're going to, the topic is not going to be on the topic of the show today, which we usually do. It's going to be on the topic of a chat item yet to be discussed. So stay tuned for that.
Yes. And we have our trio of news stories. We're going to check in on the Pennsylvania governor's race. A Republican candidate and state treasurer, Stacey Garrity, seems to have doubled down on her support of President Donald Trump, despite his falling approval rating. Interesting write-up in the Philadelphia Inquirer that looks at whether Garrity's support of the president will help or hurt her campaign for governor. According to that reporting, she attended a fundraiser at Mar-a-Lago for her campaign last week and posed for photos, shaking hands with Mr. Trump. And the president then publicly endorsed Garrity at that event. He also criticized incumbent Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro, calling him, quote, stiff.
Stiff?
Yeah, that's what he was.
The best.
That's all he had.
Yeah, he's fallen off his game. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to criticize Shapiro, but stiff, just not one of them.
Yeah, okay, and they've been going back and forth in lawsuits and all stuff, you know, sorts of things. But Garrity, she's been 10 toes down with the president since 2020 when she came on the political scene during her first run for state treasurer. She then ran again in 2024 with the president's support and broke Shapiro's record for the most votes for a statewide office. So for Garrity, who is a retired Army colonel from Bradford County, this seems to be, you know, a winning strategy for her, aligning herself with President Trump. I mean, she even repeated the lie that the 2020 election was stolen, even though she's walked back those comments. But, you know, she goes out of her way to support, to publicly support President Trump's policies. But some are wondering whether this will be a double-edged sword, Avi, especially as we get closer to the midterms when Democrats are expected to have the momentum.
Yeah, so far it doesn't seem to be working for her, if the polls are any indication. There was a recent poll from Susquehanna that had her down 22 points, I think 58 to 36.
Yeah,
it's early. Those polls still matter, though, because those are the polls that you take to the donors to say, hey, you should support me. Here's why I'm worth investing in. So even if the polls are not reflective of how public opinion will shake out in the end, they do matter at this stage. And, you know, this is the perennial conversation for all Republicans, how close to get to Trump. You certainly need him to animate the base and probably to animate donors. But this is a swing state. Even his wins in Pennsylvania have not been commanding wins. So, you know, it's tricky.
And she, Garrity, has a formidable, you know, challenger in the fact that, or should I say, formidable opponent in incumbent Josh Shapiro. He has a huge war chest. Like you said, he has 20-plus point lead, and people like him here. So there's that.
Liking does matter a lot in politics. I've come to learn that.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Story number two, let's take to the rails now. Mm-hmm. A Philly-based startup has just raised $30 million in its efforts
Cha-ching.
To decarbonize the freight train industry. This story comes our way via the Wall Street Journal. The startup is called Voltify. It's based in Center City. I like that name.
I do, too.
Here's the big idea. They want to retrofit locomotive diesel engines to turn them into basically massive EVs. Part of the process has to do with tweaking the engine design itself. The other part is that this tech would allow the batteries on the trains to recharge while moving. They would also build these things called microgrids along rail routes for trains to power up. And the ultimate goal, they say, in their comments to the Wall Street Journal, is to reduce the energy costs for freight trains by 20% and, of course, reduce carbon emissions. And they claim, by the way, Voltify, they have an agreement already with a freight rail company to start a pilot program later this year. So we'll look out for the details on that, I suppose.
Yeah, interesting, especially that microgrid technology that allows them to recharge along the way. I thought that was pretty cool. And according to the reporting, rail operators could move away from diesel without big infrastructure investments or operational changes. And that's a pretty big deal because they're like, look, all you got to do is these small little things and you can move away. But railroads only account for about 2% of the carbon emission, but this is could still be pretty huge. And I think it right now with diesel prices going up, they're almost $6 a gallon nationally, getting close. It's this is a pain point for a lot of folks. And they're like, you know what, maybe we ought to think about, you know, reducing our reliance on diesel fuel. So, and if you got alternatives like this,
we'll see if it goes somewhere. I am fascinated that they're in Philadelphia. I mean, there's some startup culture here for sure, but like this type of industry, I've just never heard of a particular startup like this. And I'm curious what the backstory is there, how they landed here. Maybe a story for another day.
And the investors are Israeli too.
They are indeed.
Interesting.
So we love technology. That's what we're talking about here. We love it so much. So that sets us up perfectly for story number three.
Yeah, well, Philadelphians are not showing much love to the new Uber Eats delivery bots. You heard about those. And some say it may be Hitchbot all over again. You know, over the weekend, someone kicked one of the bots over, and you can see it in this footage captured by FunCab karaoke security cameras around midnight in Center City. Take a look, listen. Well, you can't hear, but what you can see is someone kicking that little square bot. They kick him once, it doesn't fall over. They kick it again, and he falls over to the ground with a little light flashing. And then they kind of look over his little limp body. Almost like happy about it, like a Debo.
That was an incredibly distorted clip because of what it cut off is that then he picks it up and lets it go on its way.
Oh.
And then walks away.
There it is. Well,
did you not see that part?
I did not see that part.
This is how misinformation spreads. Yeah,
but they kicked it over. They kicked it over with force, though. By the way,
he nudged it over with his foot.
That was not a nudge.
And then picked it up.
But that is not a nudge. It took some power to knock that thing over. By the way, that bot had only been in the city for 18 days. And they're not supposed to be out past 10 p.m. So there's questions around that. And this was around midnight. And by the way, this is the second viral accosting of a delivery bot in Philly. Earlier in March, video showed someone sitting on top of one after someone had already vandalized it by writing, "Destroy me, please," on that bot. By the way, in Chicago, a video went viral of an Uber Eats robot smashing the glass of one of those bus shelters. It kind of just crashed into it and then the glass shattered. And I'm not going to say it, but I've predicted this and I'm going to keep predicting this. I don't think these bots are going to last. I think someone's going to destroy one by the time we hit summer.
Destroy one? That's the prediction?
That's one, yeah.
I don't think that's the best strategy to stop them. I think the best strategy, if that is your goal, is to like get rid of these, is to slow them down. And you could just do that by like kind of dancing in front of them. Like ultimately,
you want to dance with a bot?
No, I'm saying like if your goal, like I don't think there's going to be enough people who would destroy enough of them to dissuade them from deploying the bots. The best way to do it is to make it so it's inefficient. So people are like, well, I'm not going to wait an extra 10 minutes to get my food because they don't move very fast.
No, you could just throw some stuff in their path.
You could
they're
just
getting caught up. Well, no, kinds of things.
You're missing my point. They're very cautious by nature, as they should be. And if you like kind of like just sort of like pantomime them, right? it slows them down. Like, they're not going to go through you.
And then so if they're late, then it'll be like they're not efficient. And so you might as well go ahead and, yeah.
If you were to foresee an effective civil disobedience campaign around the Uber Eats robots, which I can't believe I just said that, that I think that would be the way to do
it. You hear Avi's a strategist over this. By the way, we told you that today was DJ of the day. So the topic is going to be robots, computers, love them or hate them. If you got a song, you can email us.
Yeah, robot song.
Robot song. Studio2@whyy.org. Send your favorite robot song.
And Hazel's going to pick it
12:30
today.
12:30. And Producer
Hazel's picking it today.
Yeah.
Do you not agree? I don't think you're going to destroy enough of them.
I just thought that somebody was going to kill one of them.
Which they might, but one is one out of how many?
There might be more killed. We'll see.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Last night, President Trump went on primetime television to make his case for the war in Iran. He took about 20 minutes to make that case. It was the first time he's addressed the nation since the war started over a month ago. And polls show he's now facing a more skeptical public.
We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong.
Trump argued that military action was necessary because Iran's nuclear program was an existential threat to America. And while he said the war would be over, quote, very shortly, he didn't provide a timeline for ending the conflict.
So where do things stand in the war with Iran? And can President Trump shore up eroding public support? Does it even matter? And what should we make of Trump's comments this week that he's considering pulling the U.S. out of the NATO alliance? Well, we've got two great guests to help us answer all those questions and more. Dominic Tierney is a professor of political science at Swarthmore College and author of several books, including The Right Way to Lose a War. Dominic, thanks for being back with us on Studio 2.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And we also have Bobby Ghosh, a columnist on geo-global politics, who writes for Foreign Affairs and Time magazine. He also writes the Substack Ghosh World. Bobby, thanks for being back with us again on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and for our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our question for you is, how much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? We'd love to get your predictions. You can call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you could drop a comment in the chat.
Dominic, I wanted to start with you. Now that we've seen the speech and we know its contents, why do you think Trump decided to go before the nation last night and deliver those remarks?
Well, usually an American president does this kind of speech at the start of the war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rather than a month into the conflict. And I think we've learned a lesson, which perhaps we should have learned a long time ago, which is that wars are easy to start, and then they tend to evolve in ways that you don't expect at the beginning. And so I think Trump's goal was to shore up support, and he presented a few key themes. Three that sort of jumped out to me mm-hmm. were threats, the grave nature of the Iranian threat, power, America's great power and capacity to crush Iran, and then victory, that we would win, we are winning, and perhaps we'll be sick and tired of winning. And those were the themes. But of course, we saw a lot of tensions. You know, if America's so powerful, is Iran really such a threat? And why has American power not produced the victory, at least as many people see it? So there's a lot of tensions there, I think.
Bobby, why do you think he made that address last night? Were you surprised there wasn't any like big information reveal contained in the speech?
I was very surprised. I think most people expected that there would be something new there, that he would either announce that negotiations had reached a stage where he was prepared to pull the United States out of the war with a very specific timeline, or that he would, based on what he had said just a couple of days before, that he would be pulling the United States out of NATO. Technically not possible, but that's never stopped him before. we were expecting some sort of a an announcement of something substantive. Didn't happen. I can only speculate here about this, but my hunch is that I think he was going to announce something and then was talked out of it. We had to be sure of what it was, but he was talked out of it, and then he was left with this commitment to speaking to the nation on primetime television, and he had to improvise. And he gave us essentially a hodgepodge of things he had already said before, as Dominic correctly pointed out, things that are often different points that he made were at tension with each other, including, you know, there were also questions unanswered. That, okay, if we are close to victory, then what does victory look like? Never mind when that happens, but what does even victory look like? Well, how do we decide when we've won? And that question remained unanswered along with many others.
Yeah, and the president used sweeping language like obliterated, decimated, Stone Age, and the reality is somewhat more mixed. And so, you know, Dominic, I'd love to get your take on when the president comes out, he gets everybody's attention, prime time, and then gives us this sweeping language when we in reality are seeing something different. What does that do? And what is that doing when, as reaction starts to come in on what he had to say last night?
Sure. Some of the language was quite striking for an American president to use, even in wartime, to talk so openly about bringing Iran back to the Stone Age. That's a very evocative phrase. He didn't threaten it. He said, that might happen. He said that will happen in the next few weeks. And it could be hyperbole, but it's, you know, from the Iranian point of view, pretty shocking. And the specific phrase, bomb back to the Stone Age, which Trump seems to be referencing, that was a phrase used by an Air Force officer called Curtis LeMay. Back in the mid-1960s. And he was referring, of course, to Vietnam and suggesting that the way the U.S. could deliver victory in the Vietnam War would be to bomb North Vietnam back to the Stone Age, that firepower would deliver this kind of World War II-style triumph. Curtis LeMay had actually been involved with strategic bombing back in World War II. But the United States did win World War II, but it couldn't win in Vietnam. So for reasons that perhaps echo a little bit what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So it is an unfortunate phrase to use because of the resonance of the failed bombing campaign in Vietnam. I think for Trump, it evoked power and strength and authority and fear. But it maybe conjured some other ideas as well.
Mm. Yeah. And Bobby, love to get your take on that, because it seems like even if Iran, they have, even if their technology, their ships and so many, the planes, whatever technology they had in this war, even if those were destroyed, they've been able to still fight back in very guerrilla style tactics. And so when you hear him talk with these bombastic type terms and the reality seems very different, what do you think the reaction is, you know, especially once he got everyone's attention?
I think the president is counting on a lot of Americans, particularly his base, to be completely ignorant of the facts, to be completely ignoring the news, not paying any attention to what's going on in Iran. I doubt that is the case, but that is clearly what he thinks, because anybody who's been paying any attention to what's going on can't possibly buy what he was trying to sell last night. The bombing to Stone Age is something that is quite apart from the Curtis LeMay precedent. It's also it's almost certain to make ordinary Iranians who don't love their government at all, who hate their government, the ordinary Iranians will find that exceptionally insulting. Iranians take a great deal of pride in how old and rich their civilization is. It goes back to, much farther than European civilization, and it's comparable only really to the civilizations of China and Egypt and Mesopotamia. And so to use that particular combination of words would be really, really insulting to a lot of Iranians. To the point that you were making, Cherry, which is that, you know, look, to the extent that we've heard from the president and from Marco Rubio about the damage that has been done by the American bombing, this is unambiguous. Iran's conventional navy is at the bottom of the sea. Iran's conventional air force has essentially no longer exists. But here's what's not being said, which is that Iran's threat to its neighbors and to the wider world has never really come from its conventional navy, those big ships, or from its conventional air force, which is made up of out-of-date old American jets. Iran's threat comes from fast speedboats and mines, by which it can close off the world's most important shipping lanes. And it doesn't need a navy to do that. It's already done that. In fact, it has done that without even actually putting the boats in the water, simply by expressing an interest, simply by saying, we're going to shut off the Straits of Hormuz. Iran has set off a cascade of events, starting with insurance companies saying, we're not going to insure any shipping. Mm-hmm. And then shipping companies say, if we've got no insurance, we're not going in there. And it has shut off the straits. So Iran can shut off the Straits of Hormuz, as it has demonstrated, without actually putting any ships in the water. That's where the threat comes from. That threat you don't take away by bombing it from the air. The threat that Iran poses to the Straits of Hormuz is geographical. Iran is right there. And you can't bomb it into a different part of the globe. Likewise, its threat from the air does not come from jets. It comes from drones and missiles. And the administration claims that it has destroyed quite a lot of drone making facilities and missile factories. We don't know that. It's hard to verify that. But to judge by the number of attacks that Iran continues to mount against Gulf countries where there are American bases and against Israel, there does not seem to be a let up. In those drone and missile attacks. In fact, I've seen some statistics that suggest that there's a small increase in the number of attacks from Iran. Mm. So the conventional forces may be degraded, as the administration says. Mm-hmm. That's not where the threat really comes from. Mm. And those things that make Iran dangerous have not gone away and really can't be bombed into any age otherwise.
We have a question for you this hour. Our listener, how much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. I want to bring in Bill from West Mount Airy, who has a comment to share with us. Bill, I hope you're well. What's your comment on Studio 2 today?
Yeah, I wanted to say, I think the paramount thing is that Trump has a very short attention span, no sense of strategy, and not much sense in the first place. And so I think that there are issues about the Strait of Hormuz, but it's a very delicate kind of thing, and it would take a lot to keep it open in terms of military force. And that doesn't even mention the possibility of mines being there that could hurt our assets. So I think that what we need to do is get together with allies and talk to them about the most sensible way to proceed, and try to get Trump a little bit less paramount in the loop and more sensible heads from our allies on board.
Mm. Thank you, Bill. Bill brings up allies. I mean, who would that be at this point, Dominic? Because we have to talk about Europe's relationship with this war. I don't think it's fair to say they're totally out. We are using European bases, not every European country, but we're using some. But obviously, it's not like Iraq, where we were able to recruit a decent number of European allies to actually fight the war alongside with us. So how would you describe Europe's involvement in this war? And what do you think it says about our relationship with Europe at this moment in time?
Well, alliances are very difficult to manage. You know, it's like a deep friendship or even a marriage or something like this. It takes a lot of work, and it can take years to build trust, and then trust can be destroyed in an instant. Mm-hmm. And the United States has succeeded over the decades in building alliances around the world, with NATO being probably the most well known. And I would say that through the ups and downs of that relationship, and there have been ups and downs, and this is not the first crisis. But through those ups and downs, the alliance have delivered enormous benefit to the United States.
Like what?
Well, there's just immediate practical benefit. You know, NATO helped, you know, deter American adversary like the Soviet Union back in the Cold War. NATO offers as bases. European countries sent forces to Afghanistan. They answered the call after 9/11, and British, Danish, other countries, their soldiers bled and died after an attack that was against primarily the United States. And the United States has contributed a huge amount to European security. And the recent, you know, people weren't living under the Red Army was in large part because of America's far-sighted alliance formation and Cold War strategy. Now, there were many mistakes, but the overall story was a positive one. But this does need tending, and my worry is that a huge amount of damage has been done through Trump's rhetoric and actions. And who's going to benefit? Well, you've got to look at Russia and China. Look at those countries and wonder, you know, they must be thinking, all the Christmases have come at once, so to speak, because they're adversary alliance, right, which at its core is the Europeans and Americans and Canadians, is splintering now.
It's fractured.
Exactly. How and do that they is take the Chinese dream.
How do they take advantage of that, though? Because it's not like now you can invade. I can't imagine you can successfully invade France because you know, there's some tension between the U.S. and France. Like, how is that actually actionable for a global superpower like a China or a Russia?
Well, the best thing you can do is to sit back and let your enemy, you know, destroy themselves, right, and cause their own problems. So China understands that it does not have the leverage to drive a wedge between the Europeans and the Americans. Trump, and some mistakes by the Europeans, but Trump seems to be doing that on his own. What they can do is take advantage of that. You know, if we remember the Cold War, how did the West win the Cold War? Well, there were a number of different reasons, but among the most important was something called the Sino-Soviet split. So communist China and communist Soviet Union split apart. And famously, Nixon went to China and the U.S. sort of moved closer to communist China.
And what, it sort of degraded them enough economically that they could no longer sustain their empire.
And the effect of that split was strategically to, in many ways, win the Cold War. China shifted from essentially the Soviet camp to an anti-Soviet camp. And by the end of the 1980s, you have Gorbachev trying to, you know, reform and the Cold War is won. So if you're China, you're thinking, okay, how do we win the 21st century? Probably the number one thing you'd like to see or up there would be Europe divided from the United
States. And you're saying that's what's happening right now. And we are either China or Russia. And Europe is our counterpart right now, and you see that happening.
Well, there's undeniable. I mean, to say tensions understates it. I mean, the United States was threatening to, you know, military invade Greenland, which is, you know, Danish territory, and Denmark is a NATO ally. Routinely, NATO allies are being attacked, and I would say, you know, I understand American grievances here. Historically, European countries did not pay their fair share for their own security. They are now trying to catch up and have dramatically stepped up their military spending. The Europeans essentially are paying pretty much the entirety of the aid to Ukraine now. So they are stepping up. And I think that the long-term consequences of this divide are enormous. You know, what you can destroy in a week would take months or years to rebuild.
Mm. Yeah. And by the way, our question of the day is, how much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can drop those comments in the chat. Akram in Philly, one of our regulars, says on YouTube, Trump literally said, "I love the poorly educated," and he absolutely counts on the ignorance of his audience. I want to bring in Linda from South Jersey, who's on the line. Linda, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My comment is this. How long will this war go on? Until the next one that starts, until the next one that starts with this administration. Is there any discussion? Does anybody know of any discussion of the 25th Amendment or a military coup for the United States to end this madness?
I don't think we're privy to those details.
We don't know, Linda. Thank you, Linda. By the way, I wanted to talk a little bit about...
By the way, 25th Amendment has to do with removing the president of the United States, just to give the context.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and people are talking about that if you're in the online social media circles. And so I wanted to talk about the Strait of Hormuz, because that goes a little bit to our relationship with allies. And Bobby, I want to bring you into the conversation because, you know, the president said in his remarks yesterday, like, the United States imports almost no oil through the Hormuz, the Hormuz Strait. And I'm quoting him. He said that's how he said it, and won't be taking any in the future. We don't need it. We haven't needed it. And we don't need it. That's what the president says. Instead, he kind of urges allies to defend the strait on their own, to take it. He says, that the United States has done the hard part. Just sort of your thoughts on that, Bobby. And, you know, given the fact that there is this growing wedge between the United States and traditional allies, just your thoughts on how they react to some of the comments said during that 19-minute speech.
Well, first of all, the point that he made about the United States not needing oil from the Persian Gulf is a profoundly economically ignorant thing to say. It doesn't matter whether the United States imports oil from the Gulf. The international prices for oil and the price we pay for gas at the station are determined by international pricing. So if the Gulf remains shut, international prices go up. And we've already seen this. The prices for gas here in the United States go up. It doesn't matter that the United States is a net exporter of oil. The fact is that if oil prices go up anywhere in the world, around the world, then they go up here. And that has a direct impact on our economy, our economies as Americans on our home budgets, but also the American economy at large. The Middle East is also no longer just about oil or gas. Mm-hmm. That's a 25-year-old view of the Middle East. Middle East is also now about fertilizer. Enormous proportion of the world's fertilizer comes from the Middle East. And this is crucial because that fertilizer has to arrive in the hands of the farmers just when they're ready to plant their fields. You miss those deadlines and the next crop comes in much lower than the last one. That has a direct impact on the price of the food we put on our table. The Middle East is also about aluminum. The great proportion of aluminum in the world comes from there. Think of all the things that go into the manufacture of aluminum. All kinds of things. The AI infrastructure that is built all over the world now, a lot of it is financed by countries in the Middle East, by the big Gulf Arab countries. So that funding gets choked out. So the economic weight of the Middle East today is much greater than it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, and the impact of all of this is enormous. Now, we're talking about allies, and we were thinking primarily of the European allies because the United States, President Trump has been attacking those allies. But there are also allies of ours in the region, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis, the Omanis, the Qataris. They're the ones left proverbially holding the baby, right? They're stuck. They can't move. They're stuck with the Straits of their dependence on the Straits of Hormuz, and they're stuck with this giant neighbor, Iran, which is now more hostile to them because it believes that they colluded with America against them. If the United States were to follow through on what the president said, that, oh, we're getting out of there, let other people clean up the mess we've made, the people at the front lines of that mess will be our Gulf allies, and they're not going to be happy at this. And the United States depends on those allies for all kinds of reasons, not just for oil and gas.
Yeah, the world is a very interconnected
it
place.
Is.
Let me squeeze in one more call before the break. We're asking you this hour, how much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. David from South Philly is online too. David, pretty briefly, could you share your comments with us on Studio 2?
Yeah, I'll be real brief. And just for full disclosure, with Peace, Justice, Sustainability Now and Peace Action. So one way I foresee the war coming to an end is if 67 senators vote for any number of war powers bills that are sitting in the Senate waiting for their return from their vacation. So if you're somebody, if your listeners, any of your listeners are opposed to this war, contact your senators. Both of our senators in Pennsylvania have said they don't want boots on the ground. Let's not wait for the boots to be on the ground. Let's vote to stop this war in the Senate. 67 senators can stop the war.
Thank you, David. If you want to join David and add your voice, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Streaming, YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Our question today, how much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the war in Iran and President Trump's address to the nation Wednesday night. In his speech, he tried to convince the American people that the war was necessary and would be over shortly, but it's not clear if the public bought that pitch. Markets tumbled and oil prices rose today. And in recent weeks, public support for the war has been eroding.
Still with us to discuss this war and the administration's messaging are Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore College and author of several books, including The Right Way to Lose a War, and Bobby Ghosh, columnist on geo-global politics who writes for Foreign Affairs and Time magazine. He also writes the Substack, Ghosh World.
Yeah, and of course, we want to hear from you, our listeners, our questions of the day. How much longer do you think this war will go on? How do you foresee it ending? We'd love to get your predictions. You can call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org, and our streamers on Facebook or YouTube, you can put those comments in the chat. Comment from LobsterC3K on YouTube, not looking forward to higher gas prices. And Susan says he will bully as long as he can until he realizes it's not diverting people from the Epstein scandal and that he's not going to get a real Nobel. I want to tee up a clip from President Donald Trump's speech last night where he's talking about gas prices. Take a look. Listen.
The hard part is done, so it should be easy. And in any event, when this conflict is over, the Strait will open up naturally. It'll just open up naturally. They're going to want to be able to sell oil because that's all they have to try and rebuild. It will resume the flowing and the gas prices will rapidly come back down.
Dominic, I want to get your thoughts on that because, you know, the president, a lot of folks are feeling the squeeze at home. A lot of Americans are very upset. You go to any gas station and people are going to be complaining about the prices. And just your thoughts. I mean, would they go back to normal? Will the prices go back to normal? Or could it just take some time? Will it require some type of action to get things closer to the way they were just a month ago?
Well, it's all going to hinge on how the war evolves. And, you know, that's the question you've posed to your listeners. And it's a great question because we just don't know. And, you know, if it were to wrap up in a couple of weeks and, you know, it was some sort of deal and the Strait reopened, then you could imagine a rally in the markets and, you know, the globalized economy would sort of absorb the friction of this event and the longer term damage, you know, outside of Iran and certain other, you know, directly affected countries, you know, might be somewhat limited in the larger scheme of things. And gas prices here for Americans would probably drop a little bit. But it's so easy to see the possibility of complications, a war that doesn't easily end. You know, why is Iran going to give up its control of the Strait, right? At the moment, it's reportedly charging countries perhaps $2 million per ship to pass through the Strait. Now, if that's the case, that's a pretty significant, you know, chokehold that Iran has. And it's, you know, it's like the toll booth and it's taking this toll. And it would see that money as completely justifiable to rebuild the country, right? From the regime's perspective, and I should say it is a pretty brutal regime and probably has become more brutal due to who we've killed along with the Israelis. But from their perspective, they were in the midst of negotiations when they were attacked. Their leaders have been killed. Their country has been devastated. And so they want reparations. And if the United States won't give those reparations, then Iran will take it through this toll. So the question is, why would it give up that control now it's been established? Mm-hmm. And I'm not even mentioning, you know, the possibility of a ground war, some of the wilder, you know, scenarios, the U.S. tries to get hold of the nuclear material and this kind of thing, which really could ripple through the global economy.
And so, Bobby, when you hear this, the president telling the American people, look, you know, everything's going to return to normal. Really, you know, it's going to be soon. It's going to naturally come down. I mean, how should folks take this when they're basically paying for this conflict?
Well, they should take it with a very large bag of salt, which is one of the few things whose price will not necessarily directly be affected. But look, jokes aside, wars don't end when one party decides that the war is over. Wars end when all the parties that are in the conflict decide that the war is agree that the war is over. And in this case, you have at least three parties, the United States, Iran, and Israel. Israel's threat perception, what Israel wants out of this war, is very different from ours. Israel has not yet decided the war is over. And as we've seen in the past, the ability of American presidents to affect Israel's calculus is very limited. The Iranians haven't decided the war is over. And to say that they will reopen the strait because that's the only way their economy can function, that may technically be true, but it underestimates the amount of pain that the Iranian regime is willing to take, or rather is willing to inflict on its own people, just to keep alive this conflict, to keep this conflict going. Mm. So I don't expect this war to be over anytime soon. And by the way, what do we mean when this war is over? I think the most likely outcome, the most optimistic outcome I can think of, is that we go from a temporary cessation of hot war back to a cold war.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The likelihood of the next hot war, a few months, a few years into the future, and no more than that. The Iranian regime will still be there. That seems now to be clear. And as long as that regime is there, it'll remain a threat to its neighbors and to the wider world. And that being the case, the threat of war will always be there.
Yeah. Heather from Wallingford believes that it will last 7 months. Mm. I want to bring in another caller. This is Desmond from Newark, Delaware, on line two. Desmond, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Yeah. First off, it's impossible to predict when this war will end, partly because it was started with the goal, according to our president, of eliminating Iran's nuclear weapon procedure. And our military intelligence already reported earlier this year Iran does not have a nuclear weapon program and hasn't since the early 2000s. So it's all a false pretense. So how can you determine when it should end? And second off, I disagree with your one of your guests there that Israel would be able to continue this by themselves. They are totally dependent on the United States for all its military supplies and armaments that it's using. And if we told them they have to stop, they'd have to stop.
Thank you, Desmond. I'll read this from the New York Times, which says, unless something changes over the next 2 weeks, the target Mr. Trump set to begin withdrawing from this conflict, he will have left the Iranians with 970 pounds of highly enriched uranium, enough for 10 to a dozen bombs. That's the New York Times reporting on the amount of enriched material that Iran has at the moment. I want to bring in another caller now. This is David from Philadelphia on line three. David, you're on Studio 2. What is your perspective?
Hi. My perspective is that this is just, first and foremost, a war that's being pursued by the U.S. government just with total incompetence, regardless of what our motives are and whether those are morally positive. It's clear that we are just doing a bad job of it. And I think the total effect of all of that is, I fear to say, a degradation of American hegemony and power on the world stage. Mm. Like, this can affect the power of the dollar.
Mm. Thank you, David. Okay, so I guess perhaps to play devil's advocate here, obviously a lot of people very disappointed with this war, the status of the war. We've talked about Iran here, and we haven't really mentioned they're actively being bombed by two of the world's most powerful militaries. A lot of their leaders have been killed. Their navy, their air force is in total disarray, if it even exists anymore. I mean, Dominic, has Iran not paid a humongous price here? Are we giving them perhaps a little bit too much credit because they've menaced this one strait and we have not yet taken the step to unmenace them? I mean, I do wonder if a little bit we've proclaimed victory a little bit too early for Iran in the current regime.
So I think that's a fair point. I
do think that the war has been negative for American interests and costly in a lot of ways. But that doesn't mean that Iran has won some great triumph. You know, we sometimes sort of think of war in this very simplified way, almost like it's a sports match, right?
Right. So there's winners and losers.
There's
yeah.
one winner and then there's one loser. And the effects of war are so much more complex than that. You know, you can't just look up at the scoreboard and see that, you know, the Eagles are 6 points up or whatever. Instead, I think war is, you know, it's asking who won a war is, it's like asking who won an earthquake, right? The starting point is everybody's lost.
Yep.
Right, that's your starting point, and everybody has incurred costs. So Iran has suffered punishing attacks, not just to its military, but to some of its civilian infrastructure as well. And you know, if the end result is that Iran looks more like North Korea, right? We wouldn't say that's a win for the United States, right? It's not also a win for the Iranian people,
yep.
who now have to live in this North Korean style regime. So,
and you think that's the more likely outcome, assuming the regime survives, that it's a more restrictive, more closed society?
You'd have to say that's the most likely scenario right now.
Bobby, do you agree with that? That would be the more likely path for a post-war Iran toward a society that is truly more cut off from the world and more determined to build a nuclear weapon?
I think it is almost certain that will be the outcome. We have already seen that more hardline, more radical elements are now in charge than they were a month ago. So yes, we took out the top leadership, but the people who were underneath them were always going to be tougher and more anti-West, and we've just empowered them and given them, in their minds, more credibility. Listen, we're not dealing with a normal form of government here. For this regime, and we have to make the distinction between Iran, the country and its people, and Iran, the regime. With this regime, their idea of victory is different from our idea of victory. Their idea of victory is that they survive. If they've survived, they've won.
Yeah.
Who pays the price? Ordinary Iranians pay the price. Their leaders don't care if ordinary Iranians pay the price. Yeah. They're not the ones paying the price. They have much nicer lifestyles than their civilians. The top government officials have access to international funding. Their children go to international universities. They can travel abroad. They've been looting the coffers of the state for two generations now. They also have access to international communication channels. So Twitter and other social media which are banned in Iran. The government officials, the high officials of government, have complete access to these. And that may seem trivial, but that's symbolic. The leaders of Iran don't care that ordinary Iranians are paying a price. So the price that we impose on ordinary Iranians, at the end of the day, does not make a great deal of difference to their leadership. Yeah. From the point of view of the Islamic Republic, the government of Iran, if they're still standing, they've won. It doesn't matter that the body of the state is bloodied and bruised and bombed back to whatever age the president has in mind. If it's still standing, if the Iranian government is still there, from their point of view, they've won.
And so I want to bring it back home because we only have a couple more minutes in the show. And talk about the politics here. We have a number of people who are talking about, the fact that this war is unauthorized and, what kind of power Congress would have. And so, and I also got to point out that, public support is low, sub 40%, and so when we talk about how often is it that a war can be so unpopular and keep going? And as we close out, just sort of what levers of power do we have here to sort of have someone, our legislative body, step in and get something stopped? And Dominic, and then if we could try to squeeze Bobby in too. So
sure, I'll just very briefly, wars are usually popular at the start. The Iraq War had 7 out of 10 Americans support it when we started, and 9 out of 10 supported the Afghanistan War. So what's striking here is its unpopularity right from the get-go. And that's partly because Trump didn't really try to build a coalition with Democrats. So there is opposition. I think Trump will pay attention to the polls. Do I see Congress, stepping up and shutting down this war? Historically, it's been very unwilling to do that. It really was right at the end of the Vietnam War that Congress really stepped in. But I think that opposition still matters. And so, you know, to something your call, one of your callers said, if people are upset about it, you know, do call your Congress member, do speak to friends and family, do make your opinion heard.
And just 30 seconds left, Bobby, your thoughts, I mean, especially as we head to the midterms.
I'm not optimistic that Congress, the Senate or the House of Representatives will step up. They've been falling down on their job for a very long time now, and I'm not optimistic that they will. But people coming out into the street like they did last Saturday may force a change. The president does care about his own popularity, does care about the polls, and that may move the needle. That is the only hope that I can hold out at the moment.
That's Bobby Ghosh, columnist on GeoGlobal Politics, who writes for Foreign Policy and Time magazine. He writes the Substack Ghosh World. Bobby, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
And thank you as well, Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore College and author of several books, including The Right Way to Lose a War. Dominic, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, now it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. I'll hit it. All right, and that was the 1978 song The Robots by Kraftwerk, a German band known for music about the relationship between men and machines. So there you go.
And our prompt today was robotics, by the way, if you're tuning in late. It was from something we talked about earlier.
During the chat, so.
I'm realizing now how jarring this must sound to someone who's just tuned in. Anyways, thank you to Gloria from Mount Airy and also Steven for choosing that song and being our DJs of the day. Runner-up today was Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robot by the Flaming Lips, which would have been my preference, and Mr. Roboto by Styx.
All right, and thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryant.
So unsettling.
I know. Al Banks engineered today's show. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY Philadelphia,
we are not robots.
And we are not, but I want to do the robot.
I had heard of the band Kraftwerk, but I realize now I've never actually heard them. And this is horrible. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you next week.